from Science of Mind magazine, August of this year. Welcome to your new life. Truth is, it's not new. It's the life you were created to live. It only seems different because of what you were told when you were young and had an impressionable mind. The truth is that you are the delight of God. This is your natural state of being. But because you are not behaving like some of those around you, you may not seem to be normal. Being normal is different from being natural. And you may experience people asking you, "Who do you think you are?" We are surrounded by a universal intelligence that responds to our words, feelings, and thoughts. It does not matter what others think of us. What matters is that what we think of ourselves. So my question to you is, who do you think you are? You're the expression of pure spirit. Think peace, and you are peace. Think love, and you are love. Think abundance, and you are abundance. Here's the exciting part. As you continue to think these thoughts, you begin to know that you are peace, love, and abundance. Now that feels good, doesn't it? Who do you think you are? You don't think, you know. You know that you are God's beloved. You know that all of your needs are met. You know that you can speak your word and have it manifest in your highest good. How do you know this? Your life reflects what is on your mind. Keep your thoughts on the best. The affirmation. I am the delight of God. I am the joy of God. I live, move, and have my beingness in the light of God.
I don't know how many of you are following along in this book, the Satchel Ernest poems. I am finding that each chapter as I read along is like a present to be opened. And I never know, because a lot of this material I haven't read before or seen in other places. A lot of this material is really interesting. So what happens is we've taken, there are 12 chapters in the book, and we're going through a chapter a month. And Connie took the first half of the chapter, or the first talk of the month on this chapter, and I'm taking the second. And it's amazing how two people will see the same chapter and talk about different things. And so I'm going to talk about something that we don't normally cover in here, which is how this all came to be. Because I found in the second part of the chapter that we read for this particular month, which is entitled What Is Known at One Point Is Known Everywhere, was Ernest Holmes himself talking about how Science of Mind came to be. And I got really stimulated by that and decided to do a little more digging. So I'm going to be going through a lot of history, and I'll bring it all to a point at the end, but it's pretty fascinating. So religious science is a part of what's called the New Thought Movement. And the New Thought Movement, I guess, was first defined in 1895. There was a metaphysical club in Boston. And they defined it as the New Thought group was to promote interest in and the practice of a true philosophy of life and happiness, to show that through right thinking, one's loftiest ideas may be brought into present realization, and to advance intelligent and systematic treatment of disease by spiritual and mental methods.
Could you read that again?
Yes. What is New Thought? The purpose of New Thought is to promote interest in the practice of a true philosophy of life and happiness, to show that through right thinking, one's loftiest ideas may be brought into present realization, and to advance intelligent and systematic treatment of disease by spiritual and mental methods. There's a group called the International New Thought Alliance that was formed in 1914. New Thought itself is not a church or a cult or a sect. It's a philosophy and it's a way of life. And since the one mind is always expanding and reaching out to better define itself, the philosophy and its students continue to grow. In fact, our own movement, religious science, we now call ourselves the Centers for Spiritual Living, and that is in the process of, there are two centers, one international and one the United, and they're merging into one. And so there's always this morphing and this growing and this new thought that comes available. Within the International New Thought Alliance itself, there are three main groups. Unity, which many of you have heard of, which is a form of new thought that is probably closest in form to Christianity. There's Divine Science, which I guess Holmes originally called Religious Science Divine Science. And of course then there's Religious Science. And Divine Science was the original name for New Thought itself. And if you're ever interested, there is a Divine Science Church in Washington, D.C., and you can go visit that. They have services and they advertise in the Post. I'm going to read to you now the Declaration of Principles that the International New Thought Alliance publishes on their website. And it's going to sound an awful like what we believe that is often in the Science of Mind magazine that's published every month. Number one, we affirm God as mind, infinite being, spirit, ultimate reality. Two, we affirm that God, the good, is supreme, universal, and everlasting. Three, we affirm the unity of God and humanity in that the divine nature dwells within and expresses through each of us by means of our acceptance of it as health, supply, wisdom, love, life, truth, power, beauty, and peace. Four, we affirm the power of prayer and the capacity of each person to have the mystical experience with God and to enjoy the grace of God. Five, we affirm the freedom of all persons as to beliefs, and we honor the diversity of humanity by being open and affirming of all persons, affirming the dignity of human beings as founded on the presence of God within them, and therefore the principle of democracy. Six, we affirm that we are all spiritual beings dwelling in a spiritual universe that is governed by spiritual law, and that in alignment with spiritual law, we can heal, we can prosper, and harmonize. Seven, we affirm that our mental states are carried forward into manifestation and become our experience in daily living. Kind of like the reading that David did. Who do you think you are? Eight, we affirm the manifestation of the kingdom of heaven here and now. Nine, we affirm expression of the highest spiritual principle in loving one another unconditionally, promoting the highest good for all, teaching and healing one another, ministering to one another, and living together in peace in accordance with the teachings of Jesus and other enlightened teachers. And lastly, number 10, we affirm our evolving awareness of the nature of reality and our willingness to refine our beliefs accordingly. And that reminds me of, the quote, I think it was from Ernest Holmes said it to his brother one time, we are open at the top, which means that we always have room to grow. Mm-hmm. So according to Holmes, in the chapter goes through some of the early influences, kind of the spiritual influences that led us to where we are today. He talks about there were sages in India. There was no big guru or prophet in India, and the teachings themselves were the byproduct of generations of thinking and teaching by these great sages. And they believe in one God, which is called Brahma, or the Absolute, One Power and One Presence in the Universe. The divine idea is a pattern that exists in everything. And that sounds an awful lot like, you know, one of the principles behind treatment, which is that behind everything there is a divine pattern. And from the Hindus, of course, Buddhist thought emerged. Buddha himself was a Hindu by birth. He followed the middle path, and one of his contributions to New Thought, one of his many contributions, was the law of cause and effect. And then Holmes shifts from the East to kind of the Mediterranean area, which was the where the birthplace of Christianity took place, and there existed a hermetic doctrine. Many of the teachings of Moses were based on this. Moses himself was raised in the Egyptian court, and he was taught that there was an idea of the law of correspondences. In other words, as above, so beneath, and as beneath, so above. Behind everything visible, there is an invisible pattern behind it. And again, that's kind of like the Indian thought as well, that there's a divine presence in everything. So the great contributions for New Thought basically come from Hinduism, Buddhism, the Old Testament, Judaism, the New Testament, and the Greeks. And I would imagine if you dug, you would find roots in other great religions, in Islam, Zoroastrianism. I think that you'd probably find some roots there, but they're not mentioned in the materials I was looking through. And I think that it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who began pulling some of this great body of thought together and making it available to the world back in the 1800s, in the 19th century. So as we look at the body of New Thought teaching, we can understand that our understanding of the philosophy will expand as we begin to live it, as we begin to practice it. So the things that we live and believe today all have their roots from thousands of years ago. So I'm going to talk now about some of the great early New Thought people, and I know Reverend Hillary knows a great deal more than I do, having studied a lot of the early teachers. But I'm going to mention some people and their contribution to New Thought. Some of the names I'm going to go through will be Phineas Quimby, whom some of you may have heard of, Walter Felt Evans, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Thomas Troward, Emma Curtis Hopkins, Wallace Wattles, and Julia Seton. So I also want to mention that a lot of them came from New England, which is where I'm from.
Obviously.
Yes. Yay, New England. Phineas Quimby, I'm going to start with him. He was born in Lebanon, New Hampshire in 1802. He was one of seven children and the son of a blacksmith. And he, you know, like a lot of these people, he didn't have a lot of formal education, even though the great universities in New England, Harvard and Yale, were available at the time. These were relatively poor people, particularly if you're one of seven children. There isn't a lot of money to go around to do other things other than feed the kids and try to get them trained for some kind of profession. So Quimby was, he had consumption in his youth, and he was given a drug by his doctor that began to rot his teeth. So he started experimenting because he realized that medicine was not going to help him. He began experimenting with some of his own ideas for a cure. And he found that if he got intensely excited doing something like riding a horse for brief periods of time, it would lessen his pain. And he became interested in the mind's ability to affect the body. And he was ultimately cured, although I couldn't find how he was cured, but it was through his own devices and not through the not through any doctor's medicine. And he saw his first a mesmerist, who's a hypnotist or hypnotherapist, in 1838. I think it was probably up in Maine, and began asking him a lot of questions about animal magnetism and its powers. And so he figured out that if he got enough training, he could become adept at as a hypnotherapist. So he quit his job. He was a watchmaker by profession. He quit his job, if you can believe it, and began traveling about as a hypnotherapist. And, you know, thinking about how that would apply to your own life, if you can imagine just quitting your job and, you know, following your bliss, as a hypnotherapist or something, that took a lot of courage. So he ran into somebody named Lucius Berkmar, who was an uneducated young man who was very susceptible to hypnosis, and he was a great medical intuitive. And the two of them traveled around doing demonstrations in front of large crowds. And he was the inspiration for somebody I'll talk about a little later, Mary Baker Eddy, who founded Christian Science. And then one of Quimby's students was a man named Walter Felt Evans, who was born in 1817. And he was the first one to start actually writing down some of the things that Quimby taught. He was also born in New England and was a farmer's son as well. And he was born in Vermont. And he went to Dartmouth for a while, but left that and decided to become a Methodist minister. And he served in a number of churches and then decided that he was going to leave that church. And he became a member of the Church of the New Jerusalem, which is also called Swedenborgian. And he began reading the works of the great seer Emanuel Swedenborg. So he made a huge change himself. You know, can you imagine quitting your job one day and moving on? Well, he did that. So his greatest contribution to thought was working out a consistent and philosophically supported system of what may be called mental or metaphysical healing. And again, his great book was Mental Cure. The main difference, and I'm going to talk a little bit about New Thought and Christian Science, they are very closely aligned. They do have similar roots, especially when you look at Phineas Quimby as having influenced both New Thought and Christian Science. The New Thought leaders embraced reason or intuition, and also they taught an amalgam of the world's scriptures as sources of spiritual truth. But Mary Baker Eddy believed that the truth could only be found in the Bible and her own writings, which, she laid out some stringent rules about the about what could and could not be done with her writings. And she felt that what she had written was divinely inspired, and she was the one, again, she was introduced to mental healing through Quimby, and her teachings have been extremely effective. There are churches of Christian Science and reading rooms all over, and my insurance plan, they will cover your treatment by a Christian Science practitioner. Emma Curtis Hopkins was taught by Mary Baker Eddy, and she was born in 1853 in Connecticut, my home state. And I want to stop here and just mention the fact that I brought up two women so far who've been a big influence on New Thought teaching. And you know, if what other faith do you know of other than maybe Islam has so much influence from women in the teaching? So anyhow, Emma Curtis Hopkins was a student of Mary Baker Eddy, but she left and went out on her own and began teaching. She's referred to as those of us who have been through a lot of science of mind training as the teacher of teachers, because so many of her students went on to found great movements of themselves within New Thought. And Ernest Holmes was one of them. Also want to mention Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was born in 1853. He was from Massachusetts. He's best remembered for having led the Transcendentalist movement in Boston. It was a group of new ideas in literature, religion, culture, and philosophy. And that, you know, there was a group of Transcendentalists that were very active in the middle of the 19th century. And he was seen as a champion of individualism. And you know, I think his great contribution was probably his his view of man as being a divine being, and the fact that he took so much of the great scriptural teachings from around the world and distilled them into his thinking. So, you know, you have to think back in context and look at time and realize that there were newspapers, there weren't the great publishing houses that we have today, and there weren't people like Louise Hay who go out and promote thinkers. These were people that were self-promoted, that nobody sent out email alerts on a weekly basis asking you to buy their books. And so a lot of them were lecturers, and Ralph Waldo Emerson was one of the foremost orators of the 19th century. So again, he was a prolific writer, he was also a prolific lecturer. And so many of his teachings affected people, not only because of the content, but because he was such a great speaker. Then there's Thomas Troward. He's the first.
Yay.
He's the first non-American.
He was not born in New England.
He was not born in New England either. He was born in India, as a matter of fact, and he was British, and he worked as a judge, and he wrote a great deal, and the start that Ernest Holmes got in teaching and talking to crowds was teaching about the writings of Thomas Troward. And he was, Troward is a judge. I guess he's a civil servant. He retired early, and his avocation had been the study of comparative religions. And so he read avidly. He was influenced by Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. His greatest teachings are probably in the Edinburgh lectures, which I think I've got with me. I brought a whole pile of stuff, and what isn't here is in Reverend Hillary's motorhome, I'm sure. But anyhow, Troward, when we're in practitioner training, this is one of the writers that we study, and you'll study too in one of the Science of Mind classes if we decide to teach that at some point. But he was. His writings may not be easily accessible to you, but they are the ones, thoughts that he had, like the action of mind plants that nucleus, which, if allowed to grow undisturbed, will eventually attract to itself all the conditions necessary for its manifestation in outward visible form. And you think about the culture and the environment that these people grew up in, this is radical thought. Okay, I'm going to mention another person who's well known, was Wallace Wattles. He grew up in Illinois, again on a farm, and he was born in 1860. And one of his basic premises is that God pervades everything and can deliver that which we focus on. And he was influenced by both Emerson and Emma Curtis Hopkins. His most famous book is The Science of Getting Rich, and there's also The Science of Getting Well, is that it? By Wattles. Anyhow, he's another famous New Thought thinker of the time. And then there's Ralph Waldo Trine, whom I was introduced to by Reverend Hillary a while ago. Again, he was born in the Midwest, in northern Illinois in 1866, and he did have a college education. He is by far the most prolific early New Thought writer, and a lot of his writings, maybe they're not well known today, but they were well known even within the general public at the time. And one of his books is called In Tune with the Infinite. Sounds wonderful. And he was heavily influenced by Emerson. I do want to say that I was delighted to find that a lot of these books are available either in digital form because they're in the public domain, or they're available in audio format. And I'm looking forward now to going and downloading some of those books and listening to them on the way into work, because there's nothing I like better than a fresh new thought. And lastly, I wanted to mention Dr. Julius Seaton, who actually influenced both Ernest Holmes and his brother Fenwick. And she was the founder of the Church and School of New Civilization. And she, again, was born in Illinois. She was born in 1862. And she brought into, brought a lot of ancient wisdom thinking into practical use in the New Age. She had, was well-learned. And I was reading about her, and she was divorced at the time, if you can imagine. Woo! There weren't many people at the time that were divorced, but you can see there's a pattern here with all of these writers, these thinkers, and that they went off, they knew they had a calling, they wrote, they found the right people to listen to or read, and they were affected themselves, and it was like all of this started snowballing, and that's eventually where we ended up with the beginning of that metaphysical society in Boston that created the definition of new thought, and then the beginning of the INTA, or International New Thought Alliance. You're probably wondering, you know, where does religious science fit in here? Holmes was influenced by all of these people. He began to study Emerson as a child in Maine, and he says a lot about himself in this chapter, probably more than any place else I have read. And I don't know where this came from. I forgot to look that reference up. But he talks about himself being a nonconformist, being his own thinker. I would imagine living on a farm, he probably he had a lot of time to think. There weren't a lot of books in the house, and I think there were 8 children, and apparently they had a lot of financial difficulties when he was young, and they moved about quite a bit. His older brother, Fenwick, was able to go to school. He went to the Hartford Theological Union and became a Congregationalist minister. But Ernest decided he was going to quit school, and he decided to move to Boston and study speech. And that's where he began to meet Christian Scientists, and it became, he began to take some of that learning that he had absorbed reading Emerson, and he began to learn more about Christian Science. I think one of the biggest influences in Holmes' life, and you only see that scattered throughout his writings, is his mother. She was a Congregationalist, and she was very smart, and she decided that the children would be taught that there wouldn't be anything to be afraid of. And Ernest was almost an adult before he learned that people were actually believing in such a place as hell. Both Anna Holmes and Ernest's father moved out to California and lived with Ernest for, I guess, the rest of their lives. And she became one of the first religious science practitioners. So she was an amazing woman. If you think about coming from a farm in Maine to living near L.A., you know, you think, what a leap that woman made. And Ernest's father, whom I've never heard anything about. So he did move in. Ernest himself moved to L.A. in 1912, where his brother Fenwick was already living, and I think he had a church in Venice, California, which is a suburb of LA. And that's when he started meeting a lot of New Thought students. He'd had the Emerson influence in Maine. He'd met the Christian Scientists in Boston. And on his own, he was doing a lot of reading. And in California, he met Julia Seton, and he began going to a lot of lectures from different people. So he decided that he needed to do things to pay the rent, and he went out and he began attending lectures, giving lectures on Thomas Troward. And so the rest is history. I'm not going to go into a lot of the early religious science, but, understand that there were a lot of thought, a lot of work that came into the teaching of Ernest Holmes. It wasn't that he was spontaneously awakened, unlike, for instance, like Paul, who had the awakening on the road. This is a gradual growing. And I think about how a lot of these people, their roots were in rural communities. Some of them came from large families. They weren't necessarily well educated. But yet, You know, if you understand that what is known at one point is known everywhere, you can understand that somehow they found that seed, the thought that attracted them, and it blossomed, and they began to spread, their own understanding of what they had learned. And think about the context as well. Christianity was well entrenched in this country, and these people were very individualist and radical thinkers from what was thought at the time commonly, except in places like Boston. So you're probably wondering, why'd she go through all that history? Well, it's because I think about how, if you try to plan it out, the founding of a major philosophical and spiritual movement, you look at all the things that happened, and they all kind of fell into place. While it was happening, it may not have seemed like it was a big deal. It was a bunch of individuals who were teaching one another, but you look at the result today, and you go, wow, we've got these thriving organizations, including this group here, and so it's not too far a reach to say it'll grow even more, it'll evolve even more. Who are the thinkers today that are advancing what we teach? Is it one of you on the street talking to another person? Is it the way we live our lives? But like I said, what's known at one point is known in every point, and you never know. So I wanted to close. I found this wonderful quote by a poet named Rilke, who's German. He wrote the Book of Hours, which was the love poems to God. And he says, "You are the deep innerness of all things, the last word that can never be spoken. To each of us, you reveal yourself differently. To the ship is the coastline, to the shore is the ship. And we are each amazing." And I wanted to thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.